chronology and some sequence to the discussion. And the panel perhaps are going to refer to the chart, and I think it'll give us a better understanding of the subject at hand. Brother Hugelmann certainly provided a good background for our discussion, and I'd like to just briefly review the proceedings in Elijah's life just prior to this event that he had witnessed there on the mount. The prophet Elijah, you remember, comes on the scene when Israel was really in trouble. They worshiped Baal. They certainly renounced the worship of the true God, and Elijah was sent to try to get Israel to return to the true worship of God. And in the course of time, as we've heard this morning, there was a demonstration made as to who would be the true God. And Elijah apparently arranged for this contest, and the prophets of Baal were to pray to their God. They arranged this altar, this bullock upon the altar, and they were to pray, asking him to consume this sacrifice of theirs with fire, indicating that he was their God. And this was done, and of course, the prophets of Baal had failed. And then it was Elijah's turn, and he made it very difficult for himself in a way. He had water poured upon that altar, and finally, with a simple prayer, as the scriptures record, he had asked God to answer him, and this was done. God answered him in the most dramatic way. The fire came down and consumed the sacrifice. And then you remember he had asked that these false prophets of Baal be slain, and this was done. And so when this was done, you remember Jezebel became quite furious. She was so angry that she immediately said that Elijah must also be slain within 24 hours, just like her prophets were. And apparently Elijah just became very frightened, became so afraid that he again went into the wilderness. He just ran away. And he was so upset that he offered a prayer to the Lord, asking him that he might just die. He wasn't interested in living again. And then he goes on, the record says, and he hides in a cave. And after being here for a little bit, then the Lord asked him a question. Elijah, what are you doing here? And then Elijah answered, and he told the Lord of some of the things that had happened. He was sure that that demonstration on the mount there would convert Israel. It didn't. And some of the problems he was having. And so the Lord then gave Elijah a demonstration indicating how he can accomplish results in different ways. And then this is recorded in 1 Kings 19, verses 11 and 12, and this will be the burden of our message this afternoon. Go forth and stand upon the mount before the Lord. And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in a wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. In other words, Elijah saw the forces of nature doing a work of destruction. And apparently, all of these demonstrations of nature didn't affect Elijah much, as did that small voice, that still small voice. This is what commanded his attention, because it was the voice of God. And so with this introduction, we'd like to get into our discussion this afternoon. Now, the first thing that we'd like to open our discussion with is a very basic question, but I think it's necessary And that is, this incident that we've just recalled, just what reasoning, we're turning to the panel now, just what reasoning would we use to establish the fact that this incident is symbolic? Just what reasoning would we use, that this is a picture of the future? Here we have these forces of nature, but we need to be assured of the fact that this wasn't merely an incident that happened back there, but where do we get the right to assign it a symbolic picture? Brother Levi, since you're right there at the head of the table, supposing you give us your reasoning on it.
I'd like to change places with him.
Now we see how well you do, Levi, and then we may change you.
Boy, that was a bad idea.
All right, we'll take that coming from you, Brother Jesuit. what I meant was in deference to Brother Huberman, because he touched on the aspect that I think applies to this particular question. I wanted to give him the right of way there. He told us, alluded to the fact that Elijah was fed by the angel of the Lord. He went to sleep, and when he woke up, there was food prepared for him by the angel of the Lord, a cake baking on coals and a cruse of water. And the voice said to him, "Rise and eat." He did. And he went back to sleep, rested again. And a second time this occurred, the cake baking on coals and a cruse of water, and again the voice was told to him, "Arise and eat." This time was a little more explicit, "For the journey is too great for thee." Now this we have all, I think, accepted as applicable to the latter day experiences during the harvest time of the class that is represented by Elijah, because it's quite obvious that Elijah is a type by the authority of Jesus. Jesus said that in connection with John the Baptist, he says, this was Elias, if you could receive him. But the implication was, of course, that he was not the real Elijah. Now, the real Elijah, as also was referred to by Malachi, had a very important mission to perform, which was to prepare the way of the Lord. Now, this is why John the Baptist could have been accepted as Elias to as many as could receive him, because this is what happened in connection with the first Advent. This was John's peculiar honor, and he did an Elijah work in his capacity of introducing Jesus to the Jews of that generation. Now, the great work, of course, to which Elijah was pointing, and this is what underlines him as a type all the way through his experiences because of the authority that Jesus gave him, is the fact that he would have the Elijah class, who would be the antitype of Elijah, this would be their work, to prepare the way of the Lord and to make straight paths for their feet. Now, this is what we say authorizes his being accepted as a type. Also, the fact that was also alluded to, that on the Mount we see the Mount of Transfiguration, which is the most outstanding vision that was presented to the apostles, and they never forgot it, was the fact that with Jesus, who had suddenly become transfigured before them into his white garments, he had Moses and Elijah on either side of him. Moses representing the Jewish gospel, the Jewish dispensation and the law, and Elijah representing the gospel dispensation. Now, all of these pinpoint Elijah as being a type. So, therefore, there's no reason for us to stop there and not make the logical projection of the fact that his important journey after having partaken of the food to the Mount of Horeb, which is a picture of the church arriving at the mountain of the Lord at this era of 1878. We're mountaintop Christians now, and we see things from God's point of view. We're also standing on the sea of glass. This is what that conveys to us. So on the strength of these sequence of references, we say that this is a natural sequence of types pointing to the culmination of the church's experience in giving, being given the vision of the winding up of earth, of the affairs of earth, in preparation for the establishment of the kingdom and the still small voice. So this is what we believe pointed to Elijah as being a type.
All right. Anyone else on the panel on the same question? All right, Brother Cook.
Well, if I understand the question, was why would we consider this, these two verses, the experience here in these two verses, 11 and 12 of 1 Kings 19, as typical, is the very fact that they depict things that are not easily accepted as literal. Have you ever heard of a wind that actually broke rock? I've heard of some strong winds and some very strong things done, but it seems to me this takes it out of the realm of literal, so that it is a figurative, a type, in other words, picturing something else that is not actually stated. As we know, that a parable is never an exact statement, but it is merely an illustration of a truth by something which is in many respects like it. And so in a sense this is like a parable. In other words, it's a word picture that doesn't actually mean what the words literally state.
All right.
If I understand that, we should quit.
Fine. Brother Rodney, do you have anything to add?
Well, we notice in the Revelation account also, which we know is a book of symbols, in chapter 7, "And after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree." Here we have other scriptures referring again to winds, and surely we're aware of the symbology of Revelation, and we would not wish to take this sort of thing literally. And there are other things here which we'd have to examine a little later.
All right, I think we have ample evidence to establish the fact that this is a symbolic prophecy. Not only from the fact that Elijah is so designated in the scriptures as being a type of the church, it's very specific, which we'll get into later on, but the symbols themselves. You'll find many, many other scriptures that deal with the winds of destruction and the earthquake and the fire. And so there's no question about this being in the symbolic sense. And it's going to be treated this way this afternoon. What we'd like to do, and I think there's a natural sequence in the scriptures, you have the wind, the earthquake, and the fire, and the still small voice. So what we're going to try to do is first identify the wind in the scriptures, use some scriptural language to enhance that, and then to try to associate that with something of a historical nature, something that's actually happened. And so this is why you'll see some of the main topics on our chart: the wind, the war, the earthquake, revolution, fire, anarchy, and so on. And I think there's a natural outline that we can just follow. So first of all, we're going to consider the wind feature of this and see just what is implied. Now, just how do the scriptures use this natural force? Is there any scriptures at all to show how this word wind or this natural force is used? Brother Rodney, you tell us.
Well, in this particular instance, it's a, we think we're justified in considering it as the winds of war. There are other instances when wind is used. For those of you who have the Bible comments, you might like to look under types and symbols under winds, and you'll find that the pastor indicates several scriptures there which may be used to show that it sometimes passes for the winds of war, sometimes for it can be used to symbolize other things. In this case, we feel that it does signify the winds of war, and I'd like to notice the words and the way in which it's put in verse 11. Now you'll notice he's standing on the mountain. As already mentioned by Brother Levi, we're in this mountain picture. We're brought right up to our day. We might even say up to the beginning of World War I, I would like to suggest. And you'll notice, behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains. Okay, now the mountains are going to be torn down by these winds. They're going to break in pieces the rocks before the Lord. Now later on, another prophet comes on the scene, and he interprets Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And here we see some parallel scriptures. Notice again the words. He says, and this, speaking of the image, this is in Daniel 2:41 now. Speaking of the toes, the last features of that image, which would bring us down to the same time period. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it of the strength of the iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Now, this is talking about a kingdom, a mountain. Then going down to verse 44, a scripture very familiar to all of us. And in the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. And you may notice, this is the explanation, and he says, forasmuch as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces this kingdom. So he says the dream is sure, and so is the interpretation. But this is God's kingdom, which is going to crush out the old kingdom. Now we turn over a little earlier, and what was the actual vision? What did he see? We read the interpretation first. Now let's look at what the vision was. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, verse 34, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, and became like the chaff of the summer thrashing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. We're going to see then that this would picture a wind of war, which would destroy the old kingdoms, the old mountains. And it would be a continuing process until none such remained. No kings would survive. Finally, as the Revelation account tells us, even the islands, republics would flee away, and the winds of war would have done their work. And we should also be aware as Bible students that there's a reason for this very careful progression in God's plan. You notice we talked this morning about how the importance of the Bible societies, without which the harvest could never have begun. Surely before the Lord would return, he would make sure that his word was available to one and all who wished it. And that's what he did. Before he could turn to the people and begin in a mediatorial phase of his kingdom, this grand process of preparing the earth would have to take place. And it's very orderly. First, the old kingdoms have to be torn down, then society will be uprooted, which we'll get into, and then finally man's sense of appreciation for any kind of authority other than God would perish. Total anarchy. Else, how could they be willing to listen to anyone else? So we're going to see a gradual progression in all this, and I think that we are going to be forced into an enlarging on these, because we're talking about just a few words and just a few verses, but it portends a very, very great event.
Well, now, Brother Rodney, would you say then that the wind specifically, we could narrow it down to war?
I would say.
You'd say so. All right, with that thought in mind now, could we, looking at our chart, Brother Cook, do you think that we could establish a beginning when the wind began to blow? And I'm thinking of something historical or something factual to establish that fact. And will there be a time where there'll be a cutoff of the wind? Can we use that as a basis there? When did it begin to blow? When will it end?
Well, I think as Bible students, we all appreciate that the real strife of of disturbance came when the what we call the First World War broke out. It was very timely. We had been looking forward to something happening in 14, and it did. And so we were very much impressed, and I surmise elated, although I was pretty young at that time. I wasn't elated, but I'm sure that many of the Bible students were, not in an improper way, as I'm tending to try to say here. But the point is that exactly on time, when the Gentile lease of dominion ended, there was a devastating war, a world-shaking war. It never occurred before. Had there occurred before a world-shaking war, and this did occur. And I think that this is in fulfillment of this Daniel's prophecy, as you all understand, I believe. I think as far as cutting it off is concerned, we have a definite cutoff time. When the still small voice begins to speak, there'll be no more wars. He'll make wars to cease to the ends of the earth, and he'll burn the machines of war or destroy them, and peace will be mandatory. I'm sure that mankind will be glad for it, but it will be commanded. He'll say, "Peace, be still," and there'll be no more war.
All right, Levi, looking at our chart, you notice that each of these stages have sort of a start from nothing, it builds up, and then it ends in nothing. Do you think there's any significance in that chart by using these spears, one at the beginning, one at the end? You notice from a nothing to a large dimension, and then it tapers off. Would that be significant to you?
Well, I think we could apply a significance to it. Perhaps some might have one concept of it, and another might have another way of looking at it, but I think that it is definitely established in our minds that this is a sequential matter. And that's the reason the vision is given to him in this order of first the wind, second the earthquake, and third the fire. They are not given to him as happening all at once, nor are they presented as coming from different directions concurrently. They are presented in sequence. Now, therefore, it would be logical for this to be illustrated by the starting point, a narrow starting point, a build-up, and then a tapering off, in order to convey the fact that one stage will merge into another, and therefore the second stage will be distinct by its own particular characteristics. Now, this does not mean that the effects of the symbolical wind do not continue to project themselves into the state of the earthquake and the fire, because it's my belief that they do. The wind continues to blow, and even as was said by Brother Lyle Cook, that the cutting off point, even for the wind, is not until the still small voice emerges on the scene. So, but however, the wind stage, it develops into something, or at least is the forerunner of something even more dramatic than the wind itself, and that's the earthquake. So I think it's proper that it should taper off to allow us to realize that there's going to be something even more significant that has to be isolated in this picture. And so it tapers off to prepare our minds to adjust to another aspect of this development, of this drama, which is the earthquake. And the same applies to the earthquake stage, I should say. It's not a literal earthquake, of course. The earthquake stage comes on the scene. It has its peculiar characteristics. It makes itself felt in its own weight. And then we will find that a new stage supersedes the earthquake stage. And so it's proper that the earthquake should taper off in this diagram to indicate that you're running into a new and distinct stage of and phase of trouble and development, according to what's presented to Elijah in its anatypical significance. And that third stage is the fire. Now that fire, as you see, begins at a point. Now I'm sure that someone else will probably be prepared to tell us why it is not tapered off at this particular point.
Anyone else on the panel on the same question? All right, Rodney.
Brother Edmund, one of the interesting things is we see the first enlarging, as Brother Levi brought to our attention, and finally it reaches its maximum width on the chart there at 1914. So this is why we find the pastor mentioning on numerous occasions that they are even preparing now for this war. And they prepared for it for those almost 40 years. And the reason was the confrontations were constantly being made and the people frustrated by it. It was inevitable that the gathering storm cloud should finally erupt, and erupt they did in 1914. Now, that was the most startling thing imaginable. The Great World War. We call it World War I, but if you looked in the old newspapers, encyclopedias, and the like, you would not find World War I listed. They only called it the Great War. There had never been a world war in the history of man, nor did they know there would ever be another. Therefore, it was only called the Great War. So it was a staggering thing, a war from which the ruling houses of Europe did not survive except as vassals to the government, to republican governmental forms of one kind or another. Now, as Brother mentioned also, finally the earthquake will come on the scene, and I think what we're seeing is that these things continue on, but mankind becomes so calloused and adjusted to them that we're almost used to living in it. We sit here today hardly remembering the fact that $23 billion of this country's economy is going into a war thousands of miles away that we aren't even interested in. That's the way life is today. Don't even imagine it. This country's annual budget, 80% of which goes into the war materials, into the defense spending, our annual budget is more than the wealth of the world, Brother Russell listed in the fourth volume at that time.
All right, I think we can establish the fact that nothing is abrupt in the way the Lord handles things. There's a small beginning, it enlarges, it does its work, and then it tapers off, another phase begins. And I think that's the idea of the chart. I think we can get the idea. Now, we'd like to just expand a little bit in this area. You notice that there's a sequence to all three of these symbols. Now, why is it that the wind was placed first? What significance is in the fact that the wind is the first in all of these stages? Why couldn't the earthquake be first, the wind second, and the fire? Why was this arrangement arranged just this way? Brother Cook, what do you think? Why was it this way? Why was the wind first? Why couldn't it be second, third?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this. I was going to keep still about it, but since you asked me, if you follow symbology, wind is a disturbance of the atmosphere. And the atmosphere, or the heavens, is a symbol of the spiritual phase or spiritual rule. And I think it's very apropos that this trouble should have started with a disturbance of the atmosphere, because that is what occurred first. Judgment must begin at the house of God. And the Lord came and found his church unworthy, neither hot nor cold, lukewarm, and he spewed them out. And they had a harvest period of 40 years long, as depicted by the parallels, which were not Pastor Russell given, only Pastor Russell pointed. These were scripturally given. And the wind is a very apt symbol of the disruption that occurred in the nominal spiritual Israel in the heavens. And notice, it was so strong that it rent the mountains and it break in pieces the rocks. Now, rock is a symbol of the true kingdom. Remember that in Revelation they're given a little stone. Each true follower is given a little stone, and in that stone a name given, nobody else knows it, but he that gave it to him and he that has it. And in Daniel's prophecy, stone is a picture of the clay is an imitation stone, and it is used to picture the spiritual ruling phase, the heavens, so-called heaven. And it seems to me very apropos that this should start with the wind, a disturbance in the atmosphere, and that's what happened. The nominal spiritual Israel lost its faith, and it ceased to function as a spiritual-minded entity. Losing that faith, fell to natural-mindedness in that harvest period. I think it's very apropos. At least that's what it pictures to my mind. Now, I'd like to point out that the Lord is not limited in his pictures. And I wouldn't want to say that the war symbol is not apropos. It is. But I think that it can also have another application. And seems to me this is very meaningful.
Well, in other words, Brother Cook, you're applying this sort of a secondary application, because we already identified the fact that this wind represents war.
This would start it actually earlier than we had intimated before, you see. It would start at about 1878, actually.
A war in the heavens,
right.
Well, it's
a disturbance. See, and war is a disturbance, no question.
All right. So in other words,
I think it fits the picture. And I rather apologize for putting it in, because maybe to some minds it'll be disturbing and upsetting. But I believe it's very apropos, and I think that it fits with the other application.
Well, now you mentioned one thing, Brother Cook. I think it's significant in the text. Now, in all three of these, you'll notice that only the wind gets sort of a special treatment. It tells exactly what the wind does, whereas the earthquake and the fire, it says nothing. It mentions merely the fact that this happened. But notice here, the wind, it rent the mountains, break the rocks, and so on. The only place of all these three where it specifically says just what it did. The other two are not mentioned.
Now, these mountains mentioned don't necessarily have to be the natural kingdoms of earth. They can be the spiritual ruling houses, as it were. A mountain simply means a kingdom or a dominion. And religious houses had their dominions too, you remember. It really shook them up. If you look back at what happened in that 40-year period, they really, a lot of things occurred.
All right, anyone else on the panel on the same question?
Well, perhaps I may, shall we say, superimpose a thought on what's been given so that you can build with some other material as well. I'm impressed with the fact that you let us into, Brother Jesuit, by the fact that this wind is specified in terms of what it did and the effects that it had. I'm impressed with the fact that this particular wind, as symbolic of the war, had a special beginning and could not be predated before 1914, because I believe that it is relevant to the picture of the smiting of the image. And therefore it was time to occur in conjunction with that event. Now, the reason I say I wouldn't be inclined to predate it is because I don't think that the war, as symbolic of the wind, could have occurred before 1914, because the Gentiles' powers had a lease. And their lease of 2,520 years gave them time until 1914. Now then, since the Lord was on the scene before that, in 1878, we would raise the question, well, why couldn't he have begun a war in 1878 affecting the Gentile powers? And the answer, because the release wasn't up. So I think this is a reason perhaps why the specifics involved with this win is correctly identified it with the war. Now, we turn to Revelation, and this is another point that's of significance to me. I don't know whether everybody else can go along with it, but if you read it, you'll notice that there's a distinction here between wind and wind, which is singular and plural. And I saw four angels.
Where are you reading from, Levi?
7:1. Revelation 7:1. And after this, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding back the four winds. Now that's plural. W-I-N-D-S of the earth. so that no wind, now it changes, it's singular, should blow on the earth or sea or upon any tree. And I think that that's not by accident or inadvertence. I think it's symbolic, because the Hebrew translation and the Greek both are parallel in their accuracy and specifics in terms of translation. So I think that the fact that the four winds are mentioned is meant to project for us the ultimate picture of a whirlwind, which will be a final phase of the culmination of all these multiple troubles at the end, or the last stage, in conjunction with the fire. And that this is the stage in which Elijah is taken up. He's taken up in the whirlwind, not in the wind. And I think this is why the four winds are mentioned. Their ultimate accumulation will be a stage of trouble that will be so severe that it is comparable to the whirlwind in which Elijah was taken up. But the wind is reverts back to what I understand Brother Russell's interpretation of wind to be symbolic of war. That's we've had all that already. So I think it specifically makes the distinction that the wind should not blow, not the wind. The wind should not blow, and this wind refers to the war. And this brings us back to the stage that we have sequentially presented on the chart. The wind, and see, I notice there it's in quotation marks. It doesn't have S on it, it has quotation mark wind. Wind was specifically the war. Wind are allowed for a broader interpretation. They may involve other elements of activation, including the evil spirits in the final culmination. They are part of the wind. But the wind itself is specifically the war, and as I say, I believe that it was time, beloved, quotation mark, time to begin its effect, and was activated in conjunction with the smiting of the image, which was 1914, because before that time, the Gentiles were entitled to have their full time of their lease.
All right, I think we can get into our second stage. We can probably spend quite a bit more time on the wind, but I think we only have so much time allotted, and we'd like to get the subject complete as we can. Let's get into the second stage. Now, first of all, let's just make a comparison between these two forces. What lesson can we obtain by comparing the wind and the earthquake? Is there a comparative study here that we could glean a lesson from? Rodney, do you think? What are these two forces? Can you make a comparison and gain a lesson?
Well, one thing that I think is important to me is that first, the wind, of course, rends the mountain, the kingdoms. It was that war which would tear down the kingdoms. It also explains why there is the sequence, or back somewhat to our previous question, but it leads to this one also, why the wind would precede this earthquake. Now, seeing that earthquake is a proper symbol of revolution, could you have a revolution without first having the war? Remember, this would be one of the great social revolutions of all time. And it could not begin as long as the kings were in power. They simply wouldn't tolerate it. After the war, they couldn't do anything about it. They had not the power to do it. So the first thing that was necessary was that the Lord would step in, tear down and destroy their authority to stop them. Then we would see the earthquake revolution, which then leads into finally the next stage. So these are sequential, because they must necessarily be sequential. It's like a terminal disease. It will go through first one step and then another, and it cannot be stopped. And this patient will finally die. And the whole world will be very happy because of it. So we look at the case of the earthquake, and nothing is specifically mentioned in the case of the earthquake, but remembering that the word contains a good deal of information. First, the earth would be the established people of humanity, established, based, fixed, not restless like the restless sea picture, but established. And we can see that fixed, established society is going to be terribly uprooted by... which would shortly follow the war, and which it did, and is continuing even now.
In other words, Rodney, you'd say that the wind was absolutely essential to provide the setting for the earthquake. The earthquake could not take place without the wind feature doing its work.
In fact, revolutions which had begun earlier, you may notice, with the exception of the United States, which was no part of the old world, that's why it was called the New World, this was the only country where the revolution was successful. Even the French Revolution finally reverted back to a monarchy when Napoleon declared himself emperor. Because, as Brother Jacobs mentioned, the 2,520 years was not up yet, and until then, the old system could not be permanently put down, so it constantly rose back up. And once the 2,520-year threshold was passed, then the revolution could really begin on a world, global scale, and that's what we've seen.
All right, now, we've already established the fact that wind represents war, and we've given some historical background to this, 1914, the Great World War, and so on. Well, now, can we in any way establish the earthquake feature with some historical event or some of the happenings today? Are we in the earthquake stage now? If we are, what about some evidence to show that fact? Anyone on the panel? Is there anything that we can substantiate the fact that we've already gone into the earthquake phase, the revolution phase, and I'd like to have something that we can see that surround us, conditions, this already taking place. Anyone? All right, Brother Levi.
I would say yes, rather definitely, because I'm impressed with the historical chain of events that we have lived through. We, those of my generation, have witnessed this war, last war, and now the beginnings of another one. We know what this means, but we also had the opportunity of witnessing a depression, and that's in quotation marks, not a recession. And I think that depression, those who remember it, was symbolic of the earthquake. Because you remember, not only was its magnitude of the greatest dimension, because it affected the entire world economy, but the profound effects that it had upon society were, in many cases, a matter of death and life. I specifically remember that when people went to the bank and found out for the first time that the banks were closed and that all their life savings were unavailable anymore, many of them committed suicide. Now, going back to that era, as I say, of course, the entire economy was uprooted, the word has been used, and then began a series of revolutions, both in approaching the problems of this nation and the rest of the outside world and how to deal with our economy. So you began to have things happening that had been considered radical. So we got social securities and unemployment insurance and compensation laws and legislations, and the government began to look after the welfare of the population on a bigger scale, which previously had been considered interference by private enterprise, because they didn't want, and of course banks began to be insured after that. Now they are definitely insured. And all of this was because they didn't want the same thing to happen again. So that's the impact that this revolution had on our society. So I would categorize that as symbolic of the earthquake, because it was real. It had a real uprooting and devastating effect upon not only the nation's economy, but upon the lives of millions of its citizens here and abroad. Now, then it set off a chain of events that, as I say, merged into these other revolutionary aspects. And this is the way an earthquake does. You see, an earthquake, you get a major shock, and you may not get any immediate results. You may get a tremor, I should say. You may not get the major shock until a little later, and then you get the cracking up of the surface of the earth, and then the tumbling in of the houses and the rattling of equipment in various homes. And then you get a series of these quakes. So this is what happens. We've got the major shock. We had tremors that were leading up to this depression. Then we had the major shock. Then we got the series of tremors, and we've been going having them ever since. And of course, now you get it on a literal scale. We've had more seismographic bustings than in the last...
Or something different. We're asking for what you've guaranteed, and the government cannot produce. Selfishness prevents even the best laid plans of men to be accomplished. Now, you'll notice what the wind did. It tore down the old order that had no intention of giving the people anything. Revolution, earthquake resulted. They said, we'll arrange things just right to give the people just what they want. Perfectly formed government, which, due to selfishness, were unable to produce what the people wanted. And it has led to a feeling of discouragement and despair like you cannot imagine. There's nothing more terrible than a person who has been frustrated knowing that the problem can be solved and that it isn't solved. This country is faced with grave problems which money cannot solve. No amount of money can solve it. The question of breach of confidence. Just don't believe the government intends to solve it. And in reality, they cannot solve it. And that same attitude pervades in other countries. It isn't just here. And these are the deep-seated roots of anarchy which say, I have no confidence in the government. It can do nothing for me. I'll have to do it myself. And so they will. And others who have similar thoughts will finally conflict one with another. And it can only lead to the extreme dissolution of the old order. And that's what we're seeing. And we, the Lord's people, should say, and it cannot come a moment too soon to suit us. Because only then can we hear that final phase, which I'm sure Brother Edmund will bring to our attention.
All right, now let's translate part of this prophecy. I think it's quite significant into present events. Remember, the wind, as Elijah observed it, the statement was made, the Lord was not in it. Then the earthquake, the second stage that we've been talking about, again, in the type, the Lord was not in it. And that happened to the fire also, that the Lord was not in it. Now just, where is the Lord in these three instances? He wasn't in the wind, he wasn't in the earthquake, or in the fire. Where is he? I mean, where does his part fit into this picture? That's very specific. After each one of these forces, the Lord was not in it. The Lord's not in it. The Lord's not in it. How do we tie that in with the prophecy?
Well, I think that is eminently significant, because we are trying to discover the methods of the Lord's operation and his relationship to the Elijah class. And I think this is significant to us because we are not in it either. And we are not participants in either the revolutionary motives or aspects or the ultimate destructive results of the fire in anarchistic uprisings. We're not participating in any of these developments, nor were we participants in the first calamity of the war. As a matter of fact, we were conscientious objectives. So, you see, we have the mind of God on these matters. We were not in it because God was not in it. But the point is, what does it mean? I think what it is meant to convey to us and to Elijah is the fact that, as we quoted from Zechariah, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, that's the Lord. And so these are strange works as far as God is concerned, but they do not represent the operations of his spirit. So that's what it means that he was not in it. He is allowing and using and permitting the interplay of forces and activities, some from Satan, some involving the evil spirits, some from man's lowly and beastly inclinations of hate and selfishness and greed and power. He's allowing these things and their interaction to bring about these various stages of troubles. But this does not represent the operations of his spirit. But he is not in this. This is, he says, the Gentile times are ended, the kings have had their day, and he is allowing these forces now that are going to result in the disintegration of these powers, which is the image, to take effect. Now, when this work is done and the destruction is over, then God will manifest his spirit and his method of operation. And that's what's on there at the end of the chart, the still small voice. I think that's the significance that he was not. There'll be such a contrast, such a distinction between God's method of bringing in. Ever since the day of Jesus, see, until from Abel to Jesus' day, a reckoning had to be made, and all the blood that was shed had to be equitized and canceled out by the troubles that came upon that particular civilization. Now, from then until now, another reckoning of justice has to be made. This is just automatic justice. And it's nothing from God especially. This is just the offering of justice. So these will take care of that. And then God will come into function in the still small voice after this work has been completed.
Well, Levi, could we use in the same discussion that you're just bringing us to the Lord's great army? I mean, it's identified as the Lord's great army, and yet he himself is not in it from that standpoint.
Yes, I think we can, on the basis of the well-known enigmatic statement of Isaiah, I create peace and I make evil. Now, this has presented a challenge to many people who've read the Bible. How can God be the author of evil? Now, we understand what he was saying to Israel was that he wanted them to realize that he was assumed complete responsibility for the catastrophes and the calamities and the troubles and the wars that came upon Israel, because they were of divine permission in fulfillment of the covenant arrangement he had made with them, that if they obeyed him and did his will, they would prosper. If they disobeyed, they would be punished. So he didn't want them to make any mistake about the fact that their punishments were accidental. So that's what he meant, I make peace and I create evil. That's the quotation. Now, as for the Lord's army, we have a similar principle application here. The Lord is telling us that he permits these motley assembly of discontents and restless masses and organized revolutionists to function in a work of destruction, because it suits his purposes to bring them down. So he assumes the responsibility for that in the sense that they are an army that he is using. Whereas if we didn't understand that, we would assume that the expression "the Lord's army," quotation mark, refers to people that are identified and affiliated with God's methods and with God's plan of working out his purposes. This is not true. The church is not in this army of the Lord's army at all, in this expression, the Lord's army. These are people who have no affiliation or necessary reverence or appreciation for God, but because he is able to use the wrath of man to praise him, he takes credit for what they do.
All right, anyone else on the panel concerning this original question? All right, Rodney.
I think in this instance, when it says that the Lord was not in this, the pastor makes an interesting statement that this might be taken this way. That is to say that the Lord's mediatorial kingdom was not in these events. In each instance, they thought that this might lead them into the kingdom, but it wouldn't. For example, the World War I was the war to end all wars, you see. Everything was always a great noble cause initially. The revolution, especially the Bolshevik revolution, there's a grand and noble cause for human right and so on. But they always deteriorated because of man's selfishness into something far from it, each accomplishing its own thing. So the Lord wasn't really in those things. And in each instance, as it disappointed the people more,
they came to rely less and less on those means for the accomplishment of it. Now, for example, have you ever tried to witness to somebody who was perfectly satisfied with his current religious view? Can't be done, can it? No one will ever receive anything from you unless he's dissatisfied with what he has. And the Lord intends to, as they say, rub our nose in it. He's going to see to it that the whole human race will come to the point of that still small voice, a small voice. He won't even have to shout anymore. He will have gotten their attention thoroughly so that they will say, this is our God. We've waited for them. We can hardly stand this any longer. This is terrible. I haven't seen anything right for so long that they'll say, this is our God. Mankind has tried every conceivable scheme and method you can think of, and we've had countries rich and poor, and none have found happiness nor success. And there is no way to have that millennial kingdom without God's program, and mankind is slowly beginning to realize that.
All right, let's now just terminate all three of these stages that we've been talking about. You notice the designer of this chart placed two question marks in this rectangle. I was wondering if the panel could supply two numbers to that.
Yeah.
Well, I'll could you supply two numbers?
They might not be the right date, but I could supply two numbers.
The correct numbers.
And I even have scriptural support for them.
All right, let's have it.
I'm afraid we've all been burned on dates, brother, and we're going to wait and we'll put them in later.
I think we're sure of the first two. There's no question about that. 19:19. The third and fourth one, I think, very precarious, and it's best that we leave that just the way it is.
It's imminent.
Yes, it's very close. All right, let's get into the last phase of our discussion, and that has to do with the still, small voice. Now, we'd like to first introduce this by why this particular type of picture that is presented to us. What is it that intrigued Elijah so much? Here he saw all of these forces, and apparently they didn't make too much of a impression upon Elijah, but when that still small voice came on the scene and he heard that, he responded like that. Now, is there any significance in this fact? Still small voice, when you relate it to all of these forces, it almost means nothing. And yet Elijah was sort of just captivated with that. Something happened, he responded, where he didn't in the other three. Now, let's just translate that into present day terminology. Just what is implied? Rodney, suppose you start the discussion.
Well, we've already noticed that the Lord was not in the first three, but the Lord was in the still small voice. It was his voice. And so naturally Elijah would be very anxious to listen to that. And also, by this time, there's nothing left. We've talked about those other two destructive forces, and finally you get down to fire. And fire is peculiar in that it, once it starts, it just continues till it consumes everything burnable. And when you're left, nothing but ashes. You're in a position to listen. And so I think the still small voice is important. It'll be important to mankind, and it's important to the church, because it means that we should be gone from the scene by this time.
All right, Brother Lyle, do you have anything on this?
Well, it reminds me of that scripture that says, thou shalt hear a voice behind thee saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. And I believe it's a still small voice, because I think it's the voice that will be inside each one. It will not be the voice that I can hear inside of you. You can't hear it inside of me, but it'll be the voice that will speak very strongly. It will be the voice of our conscience, that is, of the world. They will have learned that they must listen to the Lord. And when they think the Lord wants them to do something, they will set out to do it. And I believe that's why it's called a still small voice. It will be the activating the conscience of each one will be activating. That will be the thing that will speak to the man. Remember, Adam was made to function in absolute harmony with righteousness. He was bent in that direction, as it might be said. And so every man then will be finally brought to see God's will, and his conscience will be attuned with righteousness, so that it will be the little voice that will activate him. Seems to me this applies.
All right, Levi, could you tell us, could you translate the still small voice in action, some of the things it will utter? And I'm presuming we all agree that it applies after all of these destructive features are complete. We're talking about the millennial age. How will it act in the millennial age? Just what will be some of the features of this small voice? God is speaking, we identified that. How will it express itself? How will it affect humanity?
Well, the way you put the question, you simplify the answer that you want. I haven't a projection of the thought that I would like to add as I get through, because you make it very simple insofar as you have assumed that it applies to mankind, and you ask specifically how will it react on them. Now, I think that the definition that has been supplied to us by the pastor is extremely relevant here. And the translation, I think, that was offered by Luther and apparently received by Russell's approval. And this is translated the voice of Eden. Now, this means a lot to
the
us.
The voice of what?
The voice of Eden.
Eden.
Now, this means something to us. Because now, to us, we recognize that the voice of Eden is the voice that God spoke to Adam. Now, when God spoke to Adam, this was one of his rights that he lost. He had the right of communication and fellowship with God. Now, of course, when he was forced out of the Edenic surroundings, he no longer has that. And God has not been speaking to man ever since. But that was the still small voice. It was very quiet, impressive communication, even with Adam. And because, of course, he was in trouble, he didn't respond with any elation, as Brother Cook might say, but he heard it. But the voice of Eden refers to the fact that Adam was in his perfection, and as a son of God, he could appreciate the communication that God would convey to him. God could talk with him on that level. Now, of course, eventually this will be the case with mankind when they are restored to their Edenic perfection. They will be able to enter into communication with God and whatever method he chooses to talk with them. But the point at this stage of the trouble is that after the trouble has done its work, the still small voice as applying to mankind would mean that the mediatorial work of applying to the Ark of the Covenant the satisfaction of justice has been accomplished. Not until then can God speak with mankind. And it's pictured, as I would say, in terms of the specific, as I understand it, this is when the high priest now comes forth. Not until, this is after the marriage of the Lamb, but that's another picture. The specific here is that the blood of the goat now has been sprinkled and satisfied justice, which means, of course, that the great company are also gone. This is the specifics of the sequence. The great company have to be gone because they have a mortgage on that blood. So after that, it's all finished. Jacob's trouble has done its work. The great company are on the other side, and the ceremony of sprinkling the blood, which is a little different from the marriage ceremony, has been accomplished. Justice has been satisfied. Then the Melchizedek priesthood, which will be the manifestation of the mediatorial reign that was spoken of, will be activated. So then the high priest comes forth to bless. And in that picture of his coming forth to bless, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, is the words that were used in Moses' time, it will be the still small voice. Now, mankind will be able to respond to it on gradual levels. First, by resurrection from the dead, by their healing of the diseases, by their being brought into under the influence of the Spirit's outpouring, so the Spirit should be poured out on all flesh. This will all be the result of the new covenant arrangement, which will be entered into first by Israel, who will recognize the small voice through the ancient worthies. This will be the voice of God to them. And then the message, the law shall go forth from Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And this is the way I believe it will be affecting. They will hear the still small voice as it spreads to the hearts and the minds and the environs of every individual on the earth, because the truth shall cover the work of the earth as the waters cover the sea. And this will be the still small voice in terms of its specific relationships to man and his welfare as he comes up under the new covenant arrangement, under the mediatorial reign, recognizing that peace has been made, reconciliation has been made through the covenant between God and man.
Levi, this expression, voice of Eden, now, where is the origin of this? I didn't quite get that. Is this a translation?
That Luther supplied, and Brother Russell refers to in the reprint.
I see. I've never heard of that, and I thought it was quite interesting.
Yeah,
voice of Eden.
Yeah, voice of Eden. Mm-hmm. Now, the other thought that I was going to add, if I may, unless
okay.
you want to...
All right, we'll give you 5 minutes.
That was this, that we also, I believe, have access to the still small voice on certain contingencies. So it will not be necessary for this picture to be complete in order for us to hear the still small voice. The reason that Elijah was so impressed, so much so that he wrapped his face in the mantle, was because he recognized in the still small voice the impact of God's presence. It was not merely a voice, but it was the presence of God. He recognized that he was in the presence of God. And I'm sure he felt like Moses did. Now, to us, I think, to the church, it would mean that so long as they are under the covering of the robe of Christ's righteousness, and if they pass all the requirements that those who belong to this class have to pass, because this does not include the great company, because the great company do have to go through the trouble. They are the foolish virgins that have to go to the marketplace. But the wise virgins, they first of all hear the voice of the bridegroom. That's part of the still small voice to them. Behold the bridegroom. Not behold the bridegroom coming. So they're hearing that still small voice right along, all during this operation. And as long as they remain under the covering of the robe of Christ's righteousness and meet the requirements of faithfulness to God, which he continues to break down this class all along, the refiner's fire and the fullest soap and the purifying influences of the fiery trials, keeps them separated from all other classes and associations. Separate yourself from the people of the land. They have access to the small voice. Come, my people, enter into thy chambers, hide thyself until his wrath be overpassed. So they're in the cave, as it were, like Elijah was, but so they can hear the voice as they are come closer to the Lord. And all of this would indicate that so long as they measure up to these requirements, they can hear the small voice, because by being under the covering of the robe of Christ's righteousness, they have access to communication with God on a level as sons of God.
All right. Bobby?
I was noticing that now in the case of the wind, you notice the wind did not produce paradise, as mankind had perhaps thought, neither did the revolution. The anarchy, by this time, they've given up. All they know is that what they've got isn't. Down it goes. But it is in the still small voice, the voice of Eden, as Brother mentioned. And in reprint 5753, we have a brief mention of this. It's in an article on Elijah's flight and vision. Now, this would have been August of 1915. In none of these great experiences coming to the world will God be manifest, speaking of the previous ones. They will all be merely preparatory, terrible experiences to fit and prepare man for the voice of Eden, which will subsequently be heard. Bring the message, which will be the desire of all nations. They'll desire it by them. Think of that. The same voice of Eden is mentioned by the Lord through Zephaniah the prophet, saying that first the fire of God's jealousy will consume the present order of things, and that then, following the fire, following stage 3, following the fire, God will turn to the people a pure message that they may all call upon the name of the Lord to serve him with one consent. So this is the stage in which the world finds itself now, stage three, preparatory to hearing that still small voice, and it's our privilege to hopefully be a part of that if we prove faithful.
For a while, you have anything to add? Well, our time is up. We've gone through an hour and 45 minutes of discussion, and I'm sure that as a result of this time, that all of us have gained a deeper insight into the subject. And I think it's provided much food for thought. If you wish to pursue it, why, Brother Rodney has some papers here that you might profit from, and if there are any other questions, why, we'll just have to reserve that for a later time. So now we'll just turn the meeting over to the chairman. I want to thank especially the panel for their cooperation and their contributions to the subject.
Thank you, Mother Edmund, for being the moderator. And we also want to, again, thank the panel for their discussion. And we would also like to suggest that if you want to expand your thoughts upon the subject which we've been discussing, you might want to refer to the ninth chapter of the book of Isaiah and also to Joel, the second chapter, especially verses 2 to 11, which we think have a very strong application to this very severe time, this fire, which we are now settling down into. I'm going to ask Brother Martin now to conclude this portion of our program this afternoon with the continuance of 171, I believe it is, and ask Brother Edmund to dismiss us for the time.
Third or fourth version of 171.
Art in heaven, we continue to praise and honor thy name as we come into thy presence through him who gave his life for us. We thank thee especially this afternoon that thou hast permitted us to be part of this greater than Elijah class. Help us to be faithful. Help us that we may walk this way of faith and eventually work with thy Son in blessing all the families of the earth. And now may thy blessing continue the rest of this day, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.